jingo, won't you share our love? We will build for you a hut. You're gonna be our favorite nut. We'll have a lot of little low, by golly. Then we'll put them in the follies. By jingo, said by gosh, by gee. By Jiminy, please don't bother me. So they all went away singing, oh, by gee.
Hello and welcome to the American Writers 100 Pages at a Time podcast. And today is the penultimate episode of my look into Richard Wright's career. So it's been a fun time. I finished reading The Outsider, and I don't know. I think my overall feeling on this, it's a little bit better. I feel less disoriented compared to reading book three of The Outsider. I feel I got a better handle on what this book is trying to do and trying to achieve. I still think it's like it's parts of this are too much replicating stuff we've seen in Native Son. And then the added value of the like the political commentary, it just doesn't work. It's fine on its own. Like if Richard Wright had written essays, and I'm sure he did. I guess that's unfortunate. We don't have his nonfiction writing in this collection. It's not all of it. You know, there is a place for that kind of discussion of authoritarianism and communism and kind of future visions of social organization. And I think it's a little muddled and incoherent at times, unfortunately. And that's just, I guess, part of Richard Wright's character at this point in his thought. And then you got the existentialism, which works and sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. But the you know, at least plot-wise, the novel is more like it's a little less confusing about what is going on here. I mean, his murders, Cross Damon's murders, Damon Cross, I interchange them, I guess. It's Cross Damon. His motives are still unclear, but at least we sort of have a textual explanation of what's going on there. Now, book four, Despair. I think it's the longest in the text. I'm still doing it in one episode. I'm breaking my 100 pages rule. I've been doing that more and more lately. But it's mostly, it kind of parallels, I think it's book, which one is it in, like book two of Native Son, where it's like the cat and mouse with the police and the, like, the investigation and all that. And basically, he is identified as the murderer of those two people, the communist and the landlord that were fighting out, right? And the landlord, it turns out, was kind of a fascist. And so they're representing the two different, like, ideological extremes that are, you know, at work in the mid-20th century and deeply informing, like, Wright's politics, of course, communism, but he flirts with fascism a lot more than is comfortable, right? There's always got that asterisk, like, yeah, fascism is bad, Hitler bad and all that, but there's he opens that door a little too much to, like, the attractiveness of that ideology to his characters. And I think, is that to him too? Is part of him like, I kind of get it, and if that's true, that's a little bothersome for me. But anyways, I'm not going to try to think too much about it. I'm still overall impressed with Wright's work. And I think the first books we looked at, Law Today and Native Son and Uncle Tom's Children and Black Boy, those four works are all really excellent, top tier kind of literature, mid-century literature. But I think I'm starting to get James Baldwin's critique a little bit of it in that, and he's criticizing Native Son directly, which I wouldn't nearly criticize that nearly as much as Baldwin does. But by the time you get into The Outsider, it just seems he's a little more incoherent in his philosophy and his thoughts. And, you know, this is the kind of work I think if you went line by line with a highlighter and making marginal notes throughout and really kind of unpacked the philosophy here and the ideas, you know, that would be an exercise. That'd be a dissertation, right? I'm sure people have written their dissertation on that. It's not worth it for me to do that. I'm not going to go into that. I got to move on and start reading, you know, Go Tell It on the Mountain and moving on with my life. But it's, you know, this isn't a book I'm going to probably return to. I probably will return to Native Son at some point. But that's it. So anyways, I kind of wish he had subchapters or sections to talk about here, but he doesn't. So this picks up right where book three ends with the murder what's their names? Herdon and Gil. Gil's the communist, the one god, and Herdon is the landlord. And really they're fighting initially over like Cross Daemon staying there. That leads him to fight. And then he, instead of just like watching them fight or helping Gil, helping his comrade, you know, he's kills both of them and then tries to make it look like it was a, they just killed themselves in the fight. Right. And that's what he tells Ava, this woman he's after, right. A white woman. I don't know what we make of that and the color line stuff. We talked about that way back with the Harlem Renaissance writers. It's like the obsession of the color line among writers of the early 20th century. Black writers were really writing a lot about the color line, both how it affected them and a lot about the sexual attraction of lighter skin towards lighter skinned women among black men at the time. And it just seemed like an obsession I noticed in those works. But of course, Richard Wright himself was married to white women. Both of his wives were. So anyways, they call the party. They call Hilton, who's like a party official, to get the party in on this and to get their perspective. And essentially, Hilton is going to like approach this from several perspectives. One, he wants to protect the party, but also the idea of a fascist killing Gil. Like this landlord is determined later to be just he's called a fascist. I don't know if we have any outside direct textual evidence that he was like a true fascist. Like, you know, probably, I guess. There were lots of those types around, and it explains why he was so upset about Cross being at the house. But Hilton has this immediate idea, or at least Cross is trying to manipulate this, that if Herndon can be the one blamed for Gil's death, it'll be like a martyr for the party, and therefore his death will be used. He knew it now, he writes. Hilton had already been trying to establish the fact that Herndon was the aggressor. Cross, knowing that Gil was dead, decided that in his own defense could be the best served by his feeding the party's hunger for a martyred hero, dead or alive. He marveled at how instinctively Hilton was reacting in terms of the party organizational needs. Even describing what he had seen, he had looked down into the doorway. He had said that Gil had seen the beginning, the worst of it, blah, blah, blah. So it seems to prove it. There's evidence. There's kind of evidence on the ground there that this was a fight. That's actually what's determined initially in the police inquiry. And a lot of this chapter is just like the police questioning and investigating this and coming to determine that it was like a fight that led to both of their deaths. So it was like a double murder. Essentially, but where they killed each other, which is easy for the police because you don't have to actually prove or prosecute it. You can just clear those cases and not actually have to prosecute anyone. However, the district attorney gets involved too in this section. And his name is Eli Houston. Now, he's that hunchback guy that he met like on the train to New York way back. There was a long conversation he had with it. And he's the one who figures out that, anyways, Eli Houston was that hunchbacked lawyer that Cross met before and talked to on the way transitioning into his new life. And that's where they had that first conversation of being an outsider. And it's Houston who finds out that Cross did it and provides evidence, and that kind of leads to the climax of the novel. But mostly it's conversations that we have throughout the end of the novel. Again, that's very much like Native Son, where conversation and carries the narrative at the end. The problem in this book, it seems, is that conversation, that narrative, is just like weird, really esoteric, political and quasi-philosophical conversations about communism and fascism and things, and it's, you know, it kind of drags down the story a little bit. So anyways, plot-wise, what happens is the police eventually come after Hilton is there with you know, to represent the party. The police come and they kind of put everyone under sort of a house arrest during the investigation, as you might expect, don't leave, and they do their investigation and figure it out. And they ask them questions about what happened and all that. And through a lot of this, they're still trying to convert Cross. Remember, this is just like a day or two after there was initial contact between Cross and the communists, and they still want to recruit him. And they spend a lot of time focusing on like what the communists can do for black people. That's part of their pitch to him. And then they reemphasize that, like, your friend Gil, and of course he's not really his friend. Cross hated him for really arbitrary reasons, but just seeing him as like a god in his position at the party and a representative of this manipulative, corrupt institution or whatever. But they're like, he was killed by a fascist. Fascists are our enemies. Fascists are your enemies, right? They're really trying to argue that Cross like has a home here in the communist movement. And Wright's kind of antagonism towards the party in this book, really, I don't fully understand it, because there is a point there. I mean, there is an active fascist, anti-civil rights, anti-black, like, movement in America at the time, and the communists were actively anti-racist, and whatever their faults, right, they oppressed Richard Wright's artistic integrity? Yeah, they did, and maybe Wright had good reasons for leaving the party, but this vitriolic representation of them. And when on the surface, these are not the worst people in the world, it seems. Gil wasn't the worst person in the world, a little bit. Hilton? Definitely not. Like, Hilton actually gives this conversation about race at one point during their house arrest period, where he says, you're a Negro, and you know the instinct for that sort of thing. I don't mean a racial instinct. It's a socially conditioned instinct for dissimulation, which white Americans have bred in you, and you've had to practice it in order to survive. Watching and coping with your racially charged behavior of white Americans are part of your learning on how to live in this country. Look, every day in this land, some white man is cussing out some defenseless Negro. But the white bastard is too stupid in intelligence and deficient in imagination to realize that his actions are being duplicated a million times in a million other spots by other whites who feel hatred for Negroes just as he does. Therefore, he is too blind to see that this daily wave of million tiny assaults act to build up a vast reservoir of resentment in Negroes. At night, in home, Negroes discuss this bitterly. But the next morning, smiling, they show up at their job swearing that they love white people, end quote. So this is nothing we've not already seen in Native Son, and this is actually closer to how race is presented in Native Son. Now, what's Cross's like feedback to this? He thinks, how astute this man was. The average white American could never drag some simple truths past his lips. And here was a man confessing with fluid passions. Did the average white man suspect that men like Hilton existed, men who could easily rise above their petty feelings of racial hatred, and instead of allowing the racial phobias of the mob to dominate their lives, could cynically make use of the racially defensive attitudes instilled in Negroes by the ill treatment meted out by whites, who could use such racial consciousness as weapons in their own bitterly determined struggles for power? Blah, blah, blah. Again, why does he eventually kill Hilton? I mean, that's what happens. I'm jumping ahead, of course, to the story. But there's not that much plot we need to go to. They're under house arrest. There's this investigation. They have their conversations. So it's Ava, Cross, Hilton, this other guy, Menti, and then the police are doing their digging and asking questions, and they give their stories. And, of course, Cross is trying to frame others. Now, this, again, parallels with Native Son, where Bigger Thomas was trying to get the communists blame for the murder he did. Here he's just trying to get essentially a communist blame for the murder of a fascist, and a fascist accused of blaming, accused of, or take the blame for the murder of a communist. All that fits into the narrative of the mid-20th century ideological conflict. They're also pushing, at least the communists here are pushing, this idea that Herndon was a fascist. That was an anti-black, anti-Negro fascist, active in some kind of movement against them. So basically we have, as said later, two extremes meet, a plus and a minus, and they cancel each other out. And who could hate each other more than two men like this? It's the Russian-German war all over again. That's kind of how the police just sort of end up resolving. Now, Houston's in it, too, doing this investigation, Houston being the district attorney, this hunchback district attorney. And so that's going on, and all the meanwhile, there's still this, they're trying to use this incident to help recruit Cross into the party, this Menti and Hilton. And, you know, Menti talks to him about, like, what's your purpose in life after death? And he's like, well, there is no life after death. And it's like, no, but the party can use you, and the part, you know, that there is a, and Menti says, like, yeah, if I die and the party wants to make use of my martyrdom, make me, like, even lie about my death, whatever, if it can be propaganda purposes or organizational purposes, he's going to support that, right? And this is, of course, hinting that Cross is, if he joins the party, he can also, like, be something, partially it's to be something greater than oneself, but also to lose one's identity and actual control over the narrative of their life, which is what's going to happen to Gil, right? Gil's going to, his life is going to be, his death is going to be propagandized by the Daily Worker, by the media, by the communist media. Menti, this other communist, says, yes, that's okay for me too. But in an existential sense, this is all bad faith, right? This is allowing others to define you. But in an existential sense too, existence precedes essence. If you have no existence, your essence is outside of your control too. You lose the freedom to control that. So it's also just fact that how you're going to remember it is not under your control. That's not part of your freedom. Now, Houston actually figures it out at this point too. And all of this is kind of delivered through conversations with Cross. For instance, we have this dialogue. I'm going to read a bit of this. Here are the psychological origins of tyranny. He really goes, like, pretty far afield with his interpretations of this dual murder. But he says, don't kid yourself, boy. Napoleon, Mussolini, Stalin, Hitler knew what they were doing when they cast their beady eyes upon their subjects. When a man stood accused, objective evidence was of no avail. The dictator had but to glance into his own heart, and he knew that once that the prisoner at the bar was guilty. For he reasoned, he had stood in the prisoner's place, he would have been guilty. How in hell did he become dictator without becoming guilty, without breaking all laws in sight? Now let's get back to our third man, who realized all of this without acting upon it. Two tyrants are fighting in the room, and our third man shows up. He feels towards those two men as the two men feel towards the masses of people. He's playing the same game, but on a much smaller scale. He knows maybe he's been hurt by both sides. He kills them with no more compunction than if he was killing flies. The man who kills like that is bleak and tragic man. He is the 20th century writ small. Do you get what I'm driving at, Lane? Was Houston teasing him, or was he only talking? Cross laughed again, but still nervous dread. He told himself that he should keep quiet, and he was a damn fool to talk. Yet he felt an overpowering desire to help Houston develop his theory. The man you are describing, Cross said slowly, listening with numb dread and the sound of all his own, is one for whom all ethical laws are suspended. He acts like a god. End quote. So that's like the existential interjection here. But I want to say, what major power on earth fought the Nazis, fought fascism, and also fought against communism, right? Who fought both and thought it was the god of the 20th century. Which country comes out of the second half of the 20th century kind of as a bit of a tragic hero that ends up victorious but ends up also lost through its victory over both of these forces? Loses itself. I don't know. I almost was reading this thinking, like, kind of America almost fits this, that you have this titanic ideological struggle between these two extremes, in between Germany, Nazi Germany, and communist Russia, and the United States comes out of it kind of killing both, right, but is ideologically smaller, obviously not in terms of economic and political power, but in the ideological sense, the weaker position, the position that's not as committed to one or the other, the mixed economy, right? The New Deal consensus, the reformed capitalism that will enter into the end of the century with, you know, the declining rate of profit, the inevitable crises in capitalism that come from accumulation, all that just kind of weakening and sapping in his spirit. And it kind of drags itself across the 20th century finish line, you know, as a basket case. And that's sort of been continuing ever since. America's never quite found itself after defeating the two. But acts of God, suspending ethical laws. I mean, I don't know if that's where Richard Wright is going. I actually kind of doubt that, but that kind of entered my mind. Because as I complained last time, like picking on the American Communist Party as much as Wright does is like a little bit wild, because the American Communist Party was not a big thing. Maybe in New York, in Chicago, it had a fairly big following in some regions, but it was relatively a marginal movement. And seeing them as gods makes me kind of laugh sometimes. The real god is the capitalist world system. But that's not being critiqued here. I guess that's another criticism I have to have of Wright, is that he wastes so much ink attacking dead or dying ideologies like fascism or communism, which of course they come back and they float around and they, you know, they have their moments, but that's not the big enemy that needs to be struggled against, which is empire, right? And this is someone who went to the Bandung Conference, was at the Third World, at the center point of the Third World moment, which was all about anti-imperialism and things. But it doesn't be a big, it's not a big part of his work, unfortunately. So anyways, eventually they're released from their like little house arrest, and Hilton just, Cross just decides to like kill Hilton, which he does. He even like plans and sets up an alibi with like the hotel clerk and things, and just kills Hilton. And like the motive given, they do have a conversation before Cross kills him. And he says, like, they were such, where I'm looking for. I was like, I might forgive you if you had been going to kill me, but no, you were going to make me a slave. I would never be able to draw a free breath as long as I lived if you had your way. I'd had suffered day and night. You would have dominated my conscience. No, no, Hilton, there's more here than you say. God damn it, there is. If not, then why all this meaningless suffering? If you had killed me, that would have been a simple act. Killing Bob might have been, in a way, merciful. He wasn't happy, but to make him suffer 10 long years, hell no. To say life is just life, a simple act of accidental possession in the hands of those who happen to have it. But what's suffering? The rest in that sense is, you might argue with you that you could snatch such life blot out of consciousness and get away with it because you're strong and free to do it. But why turn a consciousness into a thing, flame of suffering, and let it lie squirming? Yeah, so he's kind of saying what Hilton's trying to do, get him to join the party, is almost worse than murder. And then he just kills Hilton for the offense of trying to like dominate him in the context of like this of being a member of the party. Again, it's like such a bizarre like obsession that Wright is having on this question. His crimes constituted so decisive a divergence from the plain and ordinary moral considerations, stem from so weird an angle of perspective, that he who would find him guilty must needs go far as to place himself in the same point of vision that he had while committing his crimes. And that person, his accuser, would automatically and of necessity have to become entangled in the very guilt he would denounce. What world word salad? I don't know. Like, I got a better sense of what's being done here than when I read part three, where I was just sort of kind of confused. But I don't know. I think I'm not fully digging it. But anyways, much of the rest of book four is the conversations between, well, we got Ava beginning her relationship with Cross now that she's freed from Gil, and that's like crossing racial lines that are, that's somewhat acknowledged in the text, and that's a bit of an issue. But mostly it's conversations with Houston and Cross. Also, like, other Communist Party officials, like that Menti and Ava, that's involved too. And, you know, anyways, Oh, there's also like a long speech that Cross gives to this other Communist Party official who shows up, this guy Blimmin. And here you get a long rant on history and industrialization and things. And again, it's almost like reading a Lovecraft letter in a way. Like, where Lovecraft would have these, if you remember my series on Lovecraft, he'd have these long dissections on history very broadly, and they kind of come off a bit as word salad, but it's a letter, so you kind of forgive it. It's like, yeah, that's the time to do it, right? It's like having a conversation at a bar or something. But Wright's trying to write a novel here. And so why is there a whole digression about like industrialization and given by our protagonist? About communism and industrialization and history and primitive man versus industrial man and all that. I guess it's kind of interesting to understand that, but I don't know if it's good. It's not good communism. It's not good Marxist theory of history. And it goes all over the place. And yeah, there's a speech to this Blimmin guy by Cross that goes on for like 10 pages. And he kind of ends up concluding that like communism and fascism are like two sides of the same coin, essentially. And this, of course, makes Blimmin flip out. And it kind of annoys me, too, that Wright kind of comes to that conclusion. But it's what we get. And so it's kind of with relief that you get to the end of book four. After reading all this, and there's good stuff in this section. I think the best is maybe like the cat and mouse with the police and with Houston between Cross. That it seems that Houston seems to know that there was a third man, and then once you know there's a third man, then it's not hard to find out that he would have been the third man, right? So like the fact that Houston uncovers that Cross was the criminal and then is not a big leap once you think there must have been a third person here. How unlikely it is that two people would kill themselves that way in a fight. It must be a third man who was available, who might have had motive. Who's this weirdo giving three-hour rants about communist history, saying communism and fascism are two sides of the same coin? Maybe the guy who killed the communists and fascists because he hated both of them. Not a big leap. So Cross is not the smartest guy, and it's not realistic that anyone would like talk this way, especially not the Cross we met earlier in the book. The Cross we met early in the book is kind of an interesting guy. Like, his life sucks. Remember me talking about how he reminded me of the character in Law Today? Like, who's an interesting guy who's like dug a hole for himself and just trying to drag himself through life, drag himself through work. We got the day in the life of a guy who's really screwed up his life. Is it entirely his fault? No, but he has to shoulder a lot of the blame for the way his life is turning out. He mistreats his wife. We have Cross here with this underage girlfriend that he got pregnant and got to deal with that. He's got to deal with his wife. He's got to deal with the debts he owes to the union and all that. And that's a more interesting story in some ways than this whole New York quest he goes on to remake himself. Yeah, I want to know more about like that early Cross. Like, that's a better story, frankly. So, I don't know. I think this book is a little, it's a lost opportunity, maybe. I don't know what to say. Who am I to pick on Richard Wright? He's earned my trust, but this particular book is, it's not quite there. Yeah, Book One Dread is like, I love that stuff. I thought that was great because it did remind me so much of Law Today, which is really an underappreciated book by Richard Wright. I would read that before I'd read Outsider again. You know, the description of him waking up in the morning and combing his hair, it's like so vivid, and it just jumped out of the page. And then you get to like these 10-page discussions of primitive man and communism and industrialization and fascist and communism as organizing principles of man and all this. It's like, where is this coming from? No one talks this way. Like, except in a Lovecraft letter. Again, that's the thing, closest thing I get to mind. But that's a letter that took Lovecraft like days to write, and it is going to come off a bit like ranty and weird, because that's the place to do it. Don't stick that into a novel. He never had to do that in his early, in Native Son. There are philosophical digressions, but they're contained and reasonable, and they're like, yeah, I believe Bigger Thomas would have these thoughts, or I believe Jan would have these thoughts, or I believe the lawyer guy would have these thoughts, because they're just sort of men. But Cross is just a, by killing Cross officially and letting him be a new person, this Lionel guy, it, you know, then he becomes like a new person. Okay, I get that. That could happen to someone, and that's a good existentialist question. But he's suddenly going to like be a professor, on a weird professor, the kind of professor that if you were in that class, you would be like, you know, raise your hand and maybe say like, is this on the syllabus? Is this on the test? Why do we have to hear this? And what's the point of it? Especially when it's sort of a confession that, yeah, I killed the communists and fascists because they both suck. All right. Anyways, that's my thoughts. I feel a little more well-grounded about this book at this point. So I almost want to apologize for my kind of flipping out when I read Descent, book three. But book four, Despair, things are laid out a little bit better, and it is slightly more interesting, but it's still, I don't know. There's a good novel in here somewhere, I think, but I don't think we're getting it, unfortunately. So in the next episode, I'll look at book five, Decision, and then wrap up my thoughts about Richard Wright. And then we'll be very shortly beginning our look at James Baldwin. We'll be doing it this way, just so if you're interested, because I'm going to start planning on how I'm going to read it. I debated whether to do like the essays first, then do the novels, or do the novels, essays, or I could do novels, early novels, do the essays, and then do late novels. And I kind of said maybe that'll be the most fun, all right? So I'm going to do the early novels first, which is Gold Toad on the Mountain, Giovanni's Room, Another Country, and Going to Meet My Man. And I'm not quite sure how it's broken up. I think Another Country is obviously the longest of these. So that would be like three episodes. Giovanni's Room, probably one. Go Tell on the Mountain, maybe two. And then Another Country, maybe four episodes. So we'll do those four novels over probably nine episodes. And then I'll read the essays, which a lot of those essay collections are short. So there's like five or six of them. And then there's some other like speeches and things, which will allow us to reflect, step back from the novels and reflect on his political life. Remember, his big criticism of Richard Wright is that Richard Wright essentially wrote propaganda that ultimately made black people look bad. So it did both. It is a protest novel, which is bad enough. So we're gonna suspect that Baldwin's not gonna be writing protest novels. He's just gonna be writing good stories drawn from life that are drawn from his experiences and his perspective on the world, but they're not going to be propaganda. That's my hypothesis going in. Some of these I have read before, but it's been years, so I'm kind of in some ways starting fresh, at least as regard to the stories. The essays I have looked at before, but after doing that, we can like reflect on his civil rights activism and his, you know, his role as a literary critic of the civil rights movement in some ways. Then we'll finish up with his later novels, as a kind of the third part of the series. And then that will sort of wrap up this look at African-American writers that just consumed me for almost, it will be a year probably before I'm done that I've been doing this. So I don't know, I might look at some of the other, I have a few other books of black writings that we can look at, like the Reconstruction documents, but most likely I'll move on at that point to women writers. But that's going to be, it's going to be at least 30 episodes or so on James Baldwin. 20, maybe 27 or so. I don't know. We'll have to recount. But anyways, that's what's coming forward. I hope you stick with me and join me in that series. So anyways, that's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time as I finish up my thoughts on Richard Wright.
Every night they sang in the pale moonlight. Oh, by gee, by gosh, by gum, by jaw. Oh, by jingo, won't you share our love? We will build for you a hut. You're gonna be our favorite nut. We'll have a lot of little, oh, by gollies. Then we'll put them in the follies.